It's good to be back together this afternoon. We are continuing our series through the book of Judges, and believe it or not, we have already made it to the final judge in the book. There is an epilogue at the end of the book. Chapters 17 through 21 give us sort of a postscript to the book. And if you remember, the book was introduced to us with a prologue. And so Judges has a couple of chapters of prologue at the beginning, a few chapters of epilogue at the end. But this is the last lesson in the meat of the book, the cycles of judges that happened in Israel's history. And again, that story is the story of Samson. And in many ways, Samson's story brings about the book's climax. His story is dramatic, and as we've been noticing, the judges often reflect the spiritual condition of the nation of Israel. And Samson, perhaps more clearly than any other judge, epitomizes the spiritual condition of the nation. And so, Samson's story is given to us in chapters 13 through 16. We won't be reading every one of these verses, but if you get lost, you'll at least be able to know where to find where we are. But we'll begin by reading chapter 13, verses 1 through 7, and this introduces Samson's story to us. So Judges chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the tribe of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." Then the woman came and told her husband, "A man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God, very awesome. I did not ask him where he was from, and he did not tell me his name. But he said to me, 'Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. So then drink no wine or strong drink, and eat nothing unclean, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death.'" Now, if you remember way back when we began these judge cycles, we noted that they go through a familiar series of steps over and over again. Othniel gave us sort of the baseline of the way this works. But as time goes on, we've been able to see different rifts on those cycles, where things have not always gone exactly the same way every time. But here, as chapter 13 begins, we see that the cycle begins with the familiar step of sin in verse 1. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And also in verse 1, we see that sin is followed by slavery. God lets the Philistines enslave them for 40 years. But this time, there's not supplication. Normally, this is the point at which Israel would cry out to God and ask for salvation. But instead, God just sort of begins to make arrangements to save them, even though they don't cry out for help. And it seems to me that the Israelites weren't so quick to oppose their Philistine captors. Maybe over time they had gotten used to living in sin, or living in slavery, I should say. And at this point, it doesn't really bother them so much. They don't cry out for help. And in fact, later in the story, we see that they cooperate pretty readily with the Philistines. But as we've seen, the angel of the Lord appears to Manoah's wife, and though she's barren, he promises that she will have a son. And he tells her that her son will be a Nazarite. This came up in our question night last Sunday afternoon. And he essentially reiterates to her what the terms of the Nazarite vow are. And you can go read those in number 6 if you'd like to. But this child will need to abstain from any grapes or grape products. He will need to stay away from dead bodies. And he will need to let the hair of his head grow long without cutting it. And normally a Nazarite vow would be a voluntary vow that people would take for a temporary amount of time. Samson's Nazarite vow is somewhat unique. He didn't choose it for himself, but it was chosen for him. And it wasn't temporary. It was intended to be for his entire life. But notice that God has big plans for Samson. In verse 5, he says that he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. You might notice that in chapter 13, Samson has God-fearing parents. Mrs. Manoah, whatever her name is, goes and tells her husband Manoah what the angel of the Lord said to her. And in the following verses, we see that they react in very godly ways. In verses 8 through 25, Manoah begins by praying to the Lord. And we see that God listens to his prayer. And when the angel of the Lord returns, Manoah is very hospitable. He offers to prepare a meal for him. And the angel of the Lord says, "No, thanks, I don't need you to prepare a meal. Instead, just prepare a burnt offering to the Lord." And so Manoah and his wife do that. And when that burnt offering is sacrificed, it says that the angel of the Lord went up into heaven in the flames. And it was at that point that Manoah and his wife knew that they had not just been in the presence of any ordinary man. And they begin to tremble with fear because they think, "We've seen the Lord. How can we live after something like that?" But notice Mrs. Manoah's faith in verse 23. I want to pick out this verse. In verse 23, his wife said to him, "If the Lord had meant to kill us, he would not have accepted a burnt offering and a grain offering at our hands, or shown us all these things, or now announced to us such things as these." I think that's pretty good logic from Manoah's wife. If God had really wanted to kill them, he wouldn't have shown them the kindness that he had shown them. He wouldn't have accepted their sacrifice and their worship. And I just think that as you think about Samson's parents, you can't help but admire the kind of relationship that they have with God. It seems like an admirable blend of faith and love and fear and reverence. They have a very high view of God, and they want to do everything that they can to be the people that God has called them to be. So at the very beginning of this story, we see that Samson is off to a good start. In verse 24, it says that the woman bore a son and called his name Samson. And the young man grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him in Mahanadan between Zorah and Eshtol. Again, Samson had godly parents. Samson had everything going for him to live a godly life. And what's unfortunate and sad is that oftentimes, sometimes at least, godly parents don't have godly children. Despite everything that Samson's parents tried to do and wanted to do for him, we'll see that over the course of his life, Samson makes many ungodly decisions. So with all of that being said, let's get into chapter 14. And chapter 14 begins to show us the kinds of choices that Samson makes. In verse 1, Samson went down to Timnah, and at Timnah he saw one of the daughters of the Philistines. Then he came up and told his father and mother, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as my wife." But his father and his mother said to him, "Is there not a woman among the daughters of your relatives, or among all our people, that you must go take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes." His father and mother did not know that it was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. At that time, the Philistines ruled over Israel. Then Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah, and they came to the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came toward him, roaring. Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and although he had nothing in his hand, he tore the lion in pieces, as one tears a young goat. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. Then he went down and talked with the woman, and she was right in Samson's eyes. I think these verses introduce Samson to us very clearly with his fatal character flaw. Did you notice all of the emphasis on what Samson saw? In verse 2, he says, "I saw one of the daughters of the Philistines at Timnah. Now get her for me as a wife." And his parents are understandably concerned because the Israelites were not supposed to intermarry with foreigners. And he replies in verse 3, "Get her for me, for she is right in my eyes." And again, it's reiterated to us in verse 7 that she was right in Samson's eyes. This is Samson's fatal flaw, that he makes his decisions based on what's right in his own eyes. And if you know very much about the book of Judges, you know that that is the same fatal flaw of the nation of Israel. When we introduced this book, we talked about how that's really the theme, is that the very last verse of this book, Judges chapter 21 and verse 25, tells us what this is all about. The last verse of the book says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." We tend to think that that will lead to blessings and comfort and satisfaction. That if we just do whatever seems right to us, that we'll get what we want. And the book of Judges shows us that that results in disaster. When the nation of Israel did what was right in their own eyes, they brought all kinds of pain and suffering and heartache. And when Samson does what's right in his own eyes, he brings the same curses upon himself. So with all that being said, what do we do with verse 4? Because verse 4 tells us that his father and mother did not know that this was from the Lord, for he was seeking an opportunity against the Philistines. That seems like a strange thing for judges to insert into the narrative, because clearly what Samson is doing is not something that God would approve of. But I think the point is not that God approved of Samson marrying a Philistine. The point is that God could use even Samson's disobedience to accomplish his purpose. God can use either the obedience or the disobedience of men to accomplish his will. And if you don't believe that, just think about the cross. Surely God didn't condone those who nailed his son to the cross. And yet he used the hard-heartedness and the wickedness and the disobedience of men to bring about the accomplishment of his will. God is greater than our obedience or disobedience. It's a privilege for us to serve the Lord. It's never good for us to disobey him, but our disobedience will not hinder God's ability to accomplish his purpose. Now, we also get a vivid glance at the kind of power that God is working through Samson here. This will be more and more clear as the story goes on. But in verses 5 and 6, there's this young lion that comes roaring towards him and his father as they're walking down this road. And it tells us in verse 6 that Samson tore the lion in pieces as one tears apart a young goat. I don't know if that's common knowledge for any of you, like how that works. You know, like, oh yeah, just like I tore apart a young goat last Tuesday. But that's apparently the way that it's written here in the text. Is that if you can imagine how easy it might be to tear apart a young goat, that's how easy it was for Samson to tear apart this young lion. But wait a second, isn't this a little bit concerning? Because Samson is supposed to be a Nazarite. Do you remember the terms of the Nazarite vow that we just talked about? He's supposed to stay away from grapes. And here he is walking through the vineyards. He's supposed to not touch a dead body. And here he is killing a lion. I don't know if these things would break the terms of the vow, but it seems dangerously close. It seems like he's flirting with disaster and trying to get as close to that line as he can. Now, as we keep reading, look at what happens in verses 8 through 10. Verse 8 says, "After some days he returned to take her, and he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and behold, there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion, and honey. He scraped it out into his hands and went on, eating as he went. And he came to his father and mother and gave some to them, and they ate. But he did not tell them that he had scraped the honey from the carcass of the lion." Now, I think this tells us something else about Samson. For one, he's just kind of nasty, you know? I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever just been like walking on the sidewalk and seen a dead animal carcass and thought, I'm going to eat whatever's inside of that. But apparently that's the kind of way that Samson thinks sometimes. But if Samson had not previously broken the terms of the Nazirite vow, then what we're seeing here is something that would definitely break them, because he's scraping honey from a lion's corpse. And if you also notice in verse 10, his father went down to the woman, and Samson prepared a feast there, for so the young men used to do. Samson isn't supposed to drink wine or grape juice, but now he's hosting a wedding feast where wine would customarily be served. And it seems to me that at this point in the story, the only part of the vow that Samson hasn't broken is cutting his hair. He hasn't broken that part yet. Well, I'll summarize verses 11 through 20. Samson hosts this feast, and he uses the feast as an opportunity to try and take advantage of the Philistine men that come to it. And he makes a wager with them. He says, let's play a little game. And the terms of the wager will be, whoever wins this game gets 30 changes of clothes. If you win, I'll give you 30 changes of clothes. If I win, you have to give me 30 changes of clothes. And the game that he plays is a riddle. The riddle is here in verse 14. He says to them, out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. I'm not an expert in this kind of thing, but that doesn't seem like a particularly eloquent riddle to me. And as we'll see throughout the rest of Samson's story, he just doesn't strike me as an intellectual giant. But besides that, not only is the riddle of questionable quality, the riddle's just not even fair, you know? Like, the idea of a riddle is that if you really sat down and thought through it and, like, really worked your way through it logically, that you should be able to come up with the answer. This isn't a fair riddle. This isn't a fair game. The only way that you could know what Samson's talking about is if you saw this weird thing that he did where he scraped the honey out of the lion corpse. I think Samson is showing us more about his character. He's not particularly clever, and he's not particularly honest. And so what happens is, of course, they can't solve the riddle. And they get to day 7 of trying to figure it out. And what they resort to doing is talking to Samson's wife and getting her to wear him down and get the answer from him. And so on the last day, they come back in verse 18 with the answer to the riddle. Verse 18 says, the men of the city said to him, on the 7th day before the sun went down, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? Now here's Samson's reply. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. All right, Samson. More award-winning poetry as he refers to his wife as a heifer. Don't write that on any cards, men. So notice that after that, he goes and gets the 30 changes of clothes that he owes them. He doesn't go down to the local Target or TJ Maxx, but in verse 19, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, and he went down to Ashkelon and struck down 30 men of the town and took their spoil and gave the garments to those who had told the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house. Now, again, you see Samson's character in the way that he handles these situations. He's emotional, he's short-sighted, he's reactionary, he's childish. And yet, you also see the way that God is using him to accomplish his purpose. God intends to use Samson to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And even in this strange riddle debacle, God ends up taking the lives of 30 of these Philistines that are oppressing his people. The chapter ends with a thud, because after that, look at verse 20. Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. So after all of that, Samson's wife is now given to somebody else. And this story just really ends in a disappointing kind of way for Samson. Now, as we move into chapter 15, We see Samson's interactions with the Philistines continue. And it begins with Samson deciding to go visit his wife. In verse 1, it says, "After some days at the time of wheat harvest, Samson went to visit his wife with a young goat. And he said, 'I will go into my wife in the chamber.' But her father would not allow him to go in. And her father said, 'I really thought that you utterly hated her, so I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister more beautiful than she? Please take her instead.'" So Samson, you know, puts on his nicest shirt, and he goes and he gets the nicest goat that he can, and he shows up to, you know, impress his wife, and his wife's father says, "Oh, I didn't think you really wanted her anymore." And you can't really blame the wife's father, because he also kind of seems to know what Samson's all about. He says, "Take her sister, she's prettier than her." And Samson, you know, is understandably upset about this. Watch how Samson reacts in verse 3. "Samson said to them, 'This time I shall be innocent in regard to the Philistines when I do them harm.' So Samson went and caught 300 foxes and took torches. And he turned them tail to tail and put a torch between each pair of tails. And when he had set fire to the torches, he let the foxes go into the standing grain of the Philistines and set fire to the stacked grain and the standing grain, as well as the olive orchards." You know, there's a lot of really crazy stuff that happens in the book of Judges, really impressive feats of strength and ability. I have always thought this is one of the most impressive things in the whole book. I don't know if you've ever tried to catch a fox before, or for that matter, any kind of wild animal, but that would be a challenge. Samson doesn't just catch one fox with his bare hands, but he catches 300 of them. And he puts torches between their tails and sets them loose in these grain fields, and he burns down the fields of these Philistines who had wronged him. It says that he struck them hip and thigh with a great blow in verse 8. Notice in verse 7, Samson said to them, let's go back to verse 6. In verse 6, "Then the Philistines said, 'Who has done this?' And they said, 'Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion.' And the Philistines came up and burned her and her father with fire. And Samson said to them, 'If this is what you do, I swear I will be avenged on you, and after that I will quit.' And he struck them hip and thigh with a great blow. And he went down and stayed in the cleft of the rock of Etam." Now, what I want you to notice in this exchange is the way that revenge creates a vicious cycle. Revenge is never satisfied. Samson cheated the Philistines with the riddle, so they cheated him back by having his wife given to somebody else. They cheated him back by getting the answer from his wife. So then he reacts by killing 30 of them, and they react by giving his wife to somebody else. So he burns their fields, and they burn his wife and her father. Then he strikes them down hip and thigh. Notice that that's always the way revenge goes. If you ever decide that you just are going to get somebody back just to even the playing field, realize that their view of that situation is probably different than yours. And if they have the same attitude that you have, they're going to want to get you back. Those of you who grew up with siblings know how that works. "He hit me because I hit him. I hit him because he hit me." And unfortunately, a lot of people don't grow out of that. Samson says, "After this, I will quit." That's a lie. Whenever we tell ourselves, "We'll just do it one more time and then we'll stop," we're lying to ourselves. And really, one more time is a lie that we tell ourselves with a lot of sins, not just revenge. But if we want to give in to our anger, if we want to give in to our lust, if we want to tell a lie, if we want to go get drunk, you know, whatever the sin is that we might struggle with, we might lie to ourselves and say, "One more time and I'll quit." Well, if that's your attitude, don't do it one more time. Just quit. Don't do it again. So what happens next in verses 9 through 17? We actually see one of Samson's most, the back and forth continues through the end of the chapter. The men of Judah actually agree to give Samson to the Philistines. And in this section, they bind him with ropes to deliver him to the Philistines. But Samson breaks out and kills 1,000 of the Philistines with a jawbone of a donkey. And notice we have more quotable poetry in verse 16. Samson said, "With the jawbone of a donkey, heaps upon heaps, with the jawbone of a donkey have I struck down 1,000 men." But it's after this that we see one of Samson's greatest moments. And I'd like to read with you verses 18 through 20. Verse 18 says, "And he was very thirsty. And he called upon the Lord and said, 'You have granted this great salvation by the hand of your servant. And shall I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of the uncircumcised?' And God split open the hollow place that is at Lehi, and water came out from it. And when he drank, his spirit returned and he revived. Therefore, the name of it was called En Hakkor. It is at Lehi to this day. And he judged Israel in the days of the Philistines 20 years. Now, this is one of Samson's most admirable moments. We see him in an uncharacteristic moment of humility. And it's no coincidence that Samson's most admirable moment happens when he's most humbled. Because for just a rare moment, he is reminded of his total dependence on God, and he cries out for help. That also reminds us of the nation of Israel, doesn't it? That as they go through these cycles of sin and slavery and supplication and salvation over and over again, that they seem to not really care too much about God until they need him for something. It's when they're sold into the hands of a foreign nation, it's when they suffer greatly that they're brought low and they're humbled and they cry out to God for help. Samson's doing the same thing. It's when he's thirsty that he's humbled. It's when he's humbled that he cries out to God. And it's at this moment that we see a rare moment of dependence on God. Now, it tells us in verse 20 that he judged Israel for 20 years. But look how quickly the narrative moves on in chapter 16. Verse 1 of chapter 16 tells us, "Samson went to Gaza, and there he saw a prostitute, and he went into her." He's right back to his old ways. He was humbled and he cried out to God, but now he sees a prostitute and decides to make his choices based on what he sees and sin against the Lord. But the thing about this is, not only is this sinful, but this decision to go into this prostitute also gives his enemies an opportunity against him. And what happens is that the people of this city, Gaza, they set an ambush for him in verse 2, and they wait all night at the gate of the city. And they think, if we wait until the morning, then we can kill him. But look at what happens in verse 3. "But Samson lay till midnight, and at midnight he arose and took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two posts, and pulled them up, bar and all, and put them on his shoulders, and carried them to the top of the hill that is in front of Hebron." You know, seeing Samson and the Philistines is almost like watching like a Tom and Jerry cartoon, you know? Like, these people just really deserve each other. And so they are constantly trying to get each other back and making fools of one another. And now Samson is on to the next woman in verse 4. Verse 4 tells us, "After this, he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek, whose name was Delilah." And again, Samson's choice to follow the sight of his eyes, to have no regard for the Lord and his will, puts him in a compromising position where his enemies can take advantage. In verse 5, "The lords of the Philistines came up to her and said to her, 'Seduce him and see where his great strength lies and by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to humble him, and we will each give you 1,100 pieces of silver.' So Delilah said to Samson, "Please tell me where your great strength lies, and how you might be bound, that one could subdue you." And this leads us to probably the most familiar section of Samson's story. This tends to be the one that we focus on in children's classes, and the one that, for whatever reason, is most memorable. And Samson begins to give Delilah some answers for what it is that gives him his strength. First, in verse 7, Samson claims, "If they bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings that have not been dried, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." But in verse 8, it tells us that the lords of the Philistines brought up to her 7 fresh bowstrings that had not been dried, and she bound him with them. Now she had been lying in ambush in an inner chamber, and she said to him, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." But he snapped the bowstrings as a thread of flax snaps when it touches the fire. So the secret of his strength was not known. Verse 10, Delilah tries again. She says to Samson, "Behold, you have mocked me and told me lies. Please tell me how you might be bound." And the same story repeats itself again, not with bowstrings, but with new fresh ropes in verses 11 and 12. And again, Delilah takes these ropes and binds him and says, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And he snaps the ropes off of him. In verse 13, Delilah says, "Until now you have mocked me and told me lies. Tell me how you might be bound." And he said to her, "If you weave the 7 locks of my head with the web and fasten it tight with the pin, then I shall become weak and be like any other man." Notice that Samson is getting closer and closer to letting the cat out of the bag. But this one doesn't work either. We see that she puts his hair into the loom and says, "The Philistines are upon you." And he wakes from his sleep and pulls away the pin, the loom, and the web in verse 14. Until finally, look at what she says in verse 15. She says, "How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these 3 times, and you have not told me where your great strength lies." And when she pressed him hard with her words, day after day, and urged him, his soul was vexed to death, and he told her all his heart, and said to her, "A razor has never come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If my head is shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." So in verse 18, when Delilah saw that he had told her all his heart, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up again, for he has told me all his heart." Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hands. She made him sleep on her knees, and she called a man and had him shave off the 7 locks of his head. Then she began to torment him, and his strength left him. And she said, "The Philistines are upon you, Samson." And he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had left him. And now with that, all 3 parts of the Nazarite vow have been broken. Samson had no regard for staying away from dead bodies. Apparently had no regard for staying away from the products of the grape. But now when his hair is cut, he loses his strength. And verse 20, I think, is just one of the saddest verses in this whole book, because it says that he did not know that the Lord had left him. It's tragic when the Lord leaves anybody. It's even more tragic if the Lord leaves you and you don't know it. And Samson is in a position where the Lord has left him. And for a moment, he doesn't even realize it. So verse 21 says that the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes and brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze shackles, and he ground at the mill in the prison. You know, Samson's fate in verse 21 is very fitting for the kind of choices that he's been making. The eyes that had given Samson so much trouble were ultimately gouged out of his head. His physical blindness and physical slavery came to match his spiritual blindness and spiritual slavery. But verse 22 foreshadows what will happen at the end of the story, because it tells us the hair of his head began to grow again after it had been shaved. And so let's go ahead and read the conclusion of Samson's story, beginning in verse 23. Now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god and to rejoice. And they said, "Our God has given Samson our enemy into our hand." And when the people saw him, they praised their god, for they said, "Our God has given our enemy into our hands, the ravager of our country who has killed many of us." And when their hearts were merry, they said, "Call Samson that he may entertain us." So they called Samson out of the prison, and he entertained them. They made him stand between the pillars. And Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand, "Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them." Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there, and on the roof there were about 3,000 men and women who looked on while Samson entertained. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, please remember me, and please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my two eyes." And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." Then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he had killed during his life. Then his brothers and all his family came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtol in the tomb of Manoah, his father. He had judged Israel 20 years. Despite all of Samson's failures in his story ends with sacrifice. And once again, Samson finds himself in a place where he's humbled. He's been brought very low. His eyes have been gouged out. His head has been shaved. He's a prisoner. He's been reduced to nothing more than a court jester for the lords of the Philistines. And it's at his lowest moment that he prays to God. And God uses him to accomplish something greater with his death than anything that he ever accomplished with his life. When you read this story, you can't help but think of an even greater story. Because when we read about Samson, it should cause our minds to think about a greater Samson. See, Samson's birth was announced by an angel, and it was miraculous since Manoah's wife was barren. Jesus' birth was announced by an angel, and you might say it was even more miraculous since Mary was a virgin. Samson was given a great mission of deliverance from the Philistines. Jesus was given an even greater mission of deliverance from the devil. Samson was betrayed by Delilah for a sum of money. Jesus was betrayed by one of his apostles for 30 pieces of silver. Samson accomplished salvation by killing his enemies in a sacrificial death. But Jesus accomplished salvation by dying for his enemies as an even greater sacrifice. Both of them gave their lives with their arms outstretched. Samson between two pillars. Jesus nailed to a cross. Samson was full of flaws, but Jesus was perfect and flawless. See, the story of Samson points us to Jesus, both by the comparisons and the contrast. Now, with all of that being said, Samson's story also gives us some practical takeaways. And before we finish, I just want to give you three practical lessons that we can take from this. Number one, Samson shows us clearly that the eye is the lamp of the body. Isn't that what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount? In Matthew 6, 22 and 23, the eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness. Whatever you allow to capture your eye will capture you. Whatever it is that you focus on, whatever it is that you lock your vision into, will be the thing that controls the course of your life. Samson's eyes were led by selfishness, worldliness, lustfulness. Over and over again, he made decisions based on what he saw as good. And it's only fitting that his eyes are physically darkened in the end. How much better off would we be if we walked by faith and not by sight? If we fixed our eyes on Jesus? If we didn't make the same mistake that Samson made, and for that matter, the same mistake that Eve made when she saw the fruit, that it was good in her eyes? And if we could say like the psalmist, your word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. But secondly, Samson also shows us that emotional decisions often involve clouded judgments. I think it's clear that Samson made a lot of impulsive decisions and that those choices were often foolish. Back in chapter 14 and verse 17, it was after his wife wore him down that he gave her the secret to the riddle. In verse 19, it tells us that he went back to his father's house in hot anger. Basically, all of chapter 15 is an emotional back and forth where he and the Philistines are trying to get back at each other. Chapter 16 and verse 4 tells us that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. And in verses 16 and 17, it was when she pressed him hard with her words day after day and urged him that his soul was vexed to death, and he told her all his heart. You know, if you are honest with yourself and the choices that you've made in your life, I would guess that probably the choices that you regret are choices that you made based on emotion. I know that's true of myself. And there's wisdom in learning to stop and think before simply reacting based on the way that we feel. Proverbs 29 and verse 11 says, a fool gives full vent to his spirit, but a wise man quietly holds it back. But the third lesson that we ought to take from Samson's story is that true strength is found in humility. For all of the physically impressive things that Samson did with his physical strength, tearing apart a young lion, catching 300 foxes, killing 1,000 Philistines with the jawbone of a donkey, those things pale in comparison to his greatest moments when he was at his physically weakest points. Remember, it was in chapter 15 and verse 18 that he was thirsty and he prayed. It was in chapter 16 and verse 28 when he was shaved and blind that he called out to the Lord for help. You see, it's when we realize our weaknesses that we realize our dependence on God. And the more that we depend on God, the stronger that we'll be. This is exactly what Paul realized in 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I'll read 2 Corinthians 12, verses 9 and 10 to bring us to a conclusion here. But as Paul reflects on his life and on the things that he's gone through and the hardships that he's faced, he concludes here in 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 9 by talking about what Jesus reminded him of. Verse 9 says, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities. For when I am weak, then I am strong. That's an important lesson for us to remember as we go through life. That hardships can actually be blessings to us because they remind us that we need strength beyond our own strength. That our own strength will fail, but the Lord's strength never will. And to think about that in terms of an invitation tonight, I want you to realize that if you are in your sins, your own strength will never be able to get you out. You'll never be able to earn your salvation by any works of righteousness. You'll never be able to break free of sin's hold on your life. You'll continue to walk in blindness, following the sight of your eyes like Samson, unless you learn to turn to the Lord's strength and not your own. But if you realize that you can't save yourself and that you need a Savior, then you're the kind of person that Jesus can save and wants to save. If you're willing to give your life to Him, you can be raised to walk in a new life, a life of victory and triumph, triumphing over sin, and one day triumphing over death. If you need to make your life right with God, I hope that as we consider the sacrifice of Samson, that you'll also consider the sacrifice of Jesus. He died for us so that we could live. And if you need to make your life right with God in any way, please come to the front. Let us know how we can help you while we stand together and sing the song.